Well, it occurred to me this week that the events in the news, the images in our culture, were a little bit more extreme than usual. On the spectrum, for example, of vice and virtue, the distance between the two, just a little bit more extended, it seems to me. I've never been fond of the "what would Jesus do" sort of movement. I mean, I understand, you know, the sentiment behind it, and it's a useful idea, but it tends to be reduced to sort of triteness by, well, Jesus would be a little more polite, or he would only take one cookie, or some such thing. You probably have never heard of, and I hadn't either, the Baguette family from Butte La Rose, Louisiana. They and 10,000 others this week were not even asked. They were told, essentially, to do what Jesus would do, and that is to put themselves, their homes, their property, in harm's way of flood, just so the people of Baton Rouge and New Orleans would be spared. The virtue end. And on the other end, we have Arnold and that guy from France tearing up a hotel room, you know. Now, that range of emotion and circumstance, you know, we understand, but mostly we find ourselves in the middle. And if all that wasn't interesting or entertaining enough, we had an end of the earth suspicion, a little more prominent than usual. Yesterday at 6 o'clock, apparently not. A lot of things that remain ambiguous and in some ways confusing. And two, that set of emotions and insights from Paul's letter to the Corinthians, chapter 13. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now we know in part, then shall we understand. In the meantime, faith, hope, and love abide. But the greatest of these is love. In the meantime, how do we live in the meantime? It would be easier to live if we knew that the meantime was over tomorrow. We could at least make our plans. It would be easier to live if we knew that the tornado would hit in an hour. I don't know whether it's easier to cope with a flood if you know in advance that it's coming. But we don't. We live in this ambiguous meantime. And so the question I want to try to address today is, how do we live in a way that is consistent with who we are, that is consistent with the principles of our faith in the meantime? I think there are at least three human characteristics, maybe blessings and gifts that God has given us, knowing that we need, in some way, these attributes or these characteristics to cope with ambiguity, to cope with life in the meantime. The first of these ways of living in the meantime is through the human attribute of compassion. And I've often talked about this. I use it as a closer for my classes. That compassion is different than pity, in that we don't simply look at the sad, sorry lot of other people's lives and say, well, that's sad and sorry. We recognize that there's little, if anything, and I would lean toward nothing, that can happen to other people that couldn't happen to us. We can't predict the lining up of the stars or the convergence of time and circumstance. If it could happen to anyone, it could happen to us. And I think that helps us, through understanding that, dial back, if not completely absolve ourselves, of the twitch to judge. To hear a story, to read something in the paper, and to initially make a snap judgment and dismiss it, because we don't know the whole story. Now, that's hard to do. The two headlines in the paper the other day, one talking about this massive budget deficit that the legislature can't quite get its head around, apparently, and then another $3 million for a golf course that's already losing money on the Texas Tech campus. Now, I love golf, and I especially like that golf course. But you have to say, well, what, you know, hello. On the other hand, I don't know the whole story. I don't fully understand what it is that goes behind that. On a bad day, I have suspicions of the unholy whiff of political infighting and wrangling. But I don't know. I don't know how the circumstances converged that led that guy in France to that level of entitlement, to seemingly feel it may be allegedly his right to abuse another human being. I know that in France and now in other places, just as in the US in the 50s, we asked ourselves the question, how do the prevailing norms of our culture make this more likely? That depending on whether one is male or female, or years back, depending on skin color, it legitimates turning people into objects. And they're calling the question in their culture. As a sociologist, I think that's a good idea. So you never know. First of all, we never know the whole story, and we never know how the story will play out in the future. I think that however we do, while living in the meantime, have the ability to find within us a very valuable human attribute, that is, compassion. And I think, secondly, we have within us an attribute that helps us live in the meantime. We can, and we sometimes even choose, to be honest. Now, I'm not talking about the always tell the truth kind of honesty, because, you know, it's the caricature of this was that, I guess there was an insurance commercial or something where Abraham Lincoln, was he always honest? And does this dress make me look fat? That's a question you better not answer, you know? Or similar such things. Because you can, you know, be cruel to someone and then ennoble that by saying, well, it's true. I think the issue that helps us live in the meantime with regard to honesty is recognizing who we are as honestly and profoundly as we know how, looking at ourselves through maybe the mirror dimly, but at least examining our reflection with an eye toward the answer to this question. How does what I believe match up with what I do? One of the more profound little vignettes in the Old Testament is where the completely powerless and certainly vulnerable to execution prophet Nathan confronts King David about his arrangements with Bathsheba and the death of her husband. Nathan tells David a story and, in a sense, calls David to task based on what he knows are David's own values. In other words, how does what you do line up with what you say you believe? And it's that disconnect that causes people great problems. Major news story in my hometown a couple months ago concerned a fellow who lives there that's on the list of the Forbes 400. He's one of the 400 wealthiest men in America. He is also currently under house arrest under $500,000 bail on the charge of abusing his stepchildren. A disconnect between who we say we are and who we are. Now, I don't know what emotional twitch there is in people that causes them to think that they need to do something like that. But you can't figure out how to deal with that emotional twitch in another way unless you recognize it for what it is. Self-examination, taking account of what it is that's a part of who you are, is a step toward honestly reconciling behavior and belief. Hypocrisy is what gets us into the most trouble. Oddly enough, you know, the data we were talking about last week, the Duke students were relatively high on risky behavior and relatively low on religion. Well, there's a consistency there, even though it's one that perhaps, you know, we might want to bring religion to bear on it in a way. But it's the hypocrisy, and I'm working on a way of actually trying to measure this, that I think elevates things like the suicide rate. In other words, I can't stand living in my own skin. I think we are given the ability to honestly examine who we are, decide what it is that's worth enriching and what it is that's worth working on to diminish, such that we bring together, or at least more closely align, who we are and who we want others to think we are. How we live in the meantime, we sometimes have to confront with brutal honesty the strengths and failings of our own lives. We can do that. And we do that, I think, through the third rather profound human attribute that helps us live in the meantime, and that is courage. Fear not, Jesus says to us, seemingly a million times. Courage in the sense that we, having come to understand who we are, offer ourselves in relationships to others. It's no accident that Paul puts this, "For now we see in the mirror dimly," insight right at the end of the great love poem. One of the most courageous things that we can do, it would seem to me, is to offer ourselves as one to another, to share the experience of love, trust, and intimacy. And it occurs in a variety of ways in all different kinds of people. I was in the bookstore the other day and was caught by the title of a book. The title is "The George Carlin Letters, The Permanent Courtship of Sally Wade." Sally Wade is George Carlin's second wife. His first wife, Brenda, to whom he was married for a long time, died of cancer in the late 90s. And a few years later, he married Sally. And at the end of his life, Sally has published a book that are essentially copies of all the little notes and letters and drawings and scribbles and doodles that he would leave for her around the house. And it simply illustrates a person who arguably had great virtue and was victim to great vice, who loved deeply and lost big and chose to love again. Intriguing little book. The risk, the courage it takes to decide, I will allow myself, knowing myself as I do, to be loved by someone else. Compassion, honesty, courage, these are what I think it means to be fully human, as opposed to only human. You know, we say I'm only human, and it sort of implies like I'm kind of one step up from the pigs. To be fully human is to be quite literally what the Bible calls us, one step lower than the angels. And living in the meantime, as fully human as we can find the wit and the will to be, we will find ourselves in a position when one day, probably not October 21st, but you never know, when the angels call us home, we see face to face. Now, in the meantime, through the mirror dimly. But we can live with that, with compassion, with honesty, with courage. Amen.